Please be seated. And would you also let's thank the worship team from Light Church Kirkham. Yeah. Now I'm trying to see where the newly ordained are. Just raise your hands. Let's see. Albert's here. Yeah, okay. I just want to see where you're at. So this is, these are some thoughts for those who are newly ordained. I need to remind you that being ordained does not mean that you will be teleported out of this world and into, you know, immediately into the presence of God. You're still going to have to stand in line at Tesco. A cup of coffee at Costa will still cost you £3. This ancient rite of ordination does not mean that you will be insulated from the madness. Ordination simply means you're being sent into the madness with a new urgency and with a new authority to care for God's church. This is what it is. The ordination places the approval of the historic church upon you as you boldly venture into the madness with a message. And that's where I want to focus this evening for a few moments. There was a day when simply being ordained meant that people had to listen to you. You know, everyone kind of had to go to church and at least had to pretend to listen to us. Not today. That day is long gone. So I want us to think this evening about that message about Jesus, that message to our real life neighbors, in our context, in this year, in 2018. And I'm going to suggest that a model for us may be an old, old letter written to a group of people, an ethnic group of people, called the Hebrew people. These were a unique people. You could characterize them as a strange people. They were set apart from those among whom they lived. They thought they were God's gift to humanity. These were a people who received a letter about how to talk about Jesus. That old letter is included in the New Testament. We call it the Epistle to the Hebrews. The person who wrote that letter, we don't know who it was. Many speculate that it might have been a woman. It might have been Priscilla. And perhaps for that reason, her name was not attached to it. It may have been Apollos, but I don't think so with all the Hebraic references. But whoever wrote it, we don't know who wrote it, so I'm just going to talk about the author. The author wanted these people to understand that their old ways were not the destination. They were just a pathway to Jesus. The old ways were preparatory. The old ways were in anticipation of Jesus. The old ways weren't wrong. They were just not full. They were incomplete. They weren't the whole thing. So this old letter understands, it's kind of like, I don't know if you have paint by number for children. I think you do, yes. So it was kind of like the author is saying, your old ways were paint by number, but now you are artist, and now you have all the colors of the palette at your disposal. So the author takes his or her knowledge of the old ways. I think you see where I'm going with this. Maybe not quite yet. The author takes his or her knowledge of their old ways and builds on them to get them to Jesus. The author doesn't say, before you were barbaric sinners, and now you're not. Instead, the author takes the old things that they trusted in, the customary crutches upon which they leaned, and he shows how Jesus is really what they were looking for all along. And now you clearly see where I'm going. So the author of the book of Hebrews says, Before you listen to angels' messages. Jesus' message is far superior to angels. Before you made animal sacrifices, Jesus' sacrifice, the scope is for everyone, everywhere, in all time. before you had these human high priests, and now you have a perfect high priest. Before you had heroes, who were Abraham and Moses, and now you have a superhero. Before you had Melchizedek, now you have Jesus. Before you had the tabernacle, now you see what he or she's doing, just taking everything and helping the Hebrews see how what they trusted in actually are leading them toward Jesus. Now, all of this was super meaningful to these people because they understood what the tabernacle meant. They understood who Melchizedek was. They understood the significance of killing a goat on a bronze altar. But guess what? That is not significant to your neighbors. And herein lies the problem of your message today, new elders. So how do you take the story of Melchizedek and make that meaningful? So I wanted tonight to preach about Melchizedek. I love the story. You know, I know the story. You know the story. You know Abraham going out to rescue Lot from the five kings of the north, coming back, and here comes the king of Shalom, the king of peace, the king of Jerusalem comes out. That's Melchizedek. He comes out, and Abraham gives him the tithe. It's this first offering to God. So I know that story. I want to tell that story, but try going to your neighbors. You might want to write this down because it's a little complex. But try going to your neighbors and suggesting to them they should follow Jesus because, and here's the argument, here's why they should follow Jesus, because Levi really tithed to Melchizedek, since Levi was in Abraham's loins when Abraham tithed to Melchizedek. Did you get that? You know, your neighbors are not going to get the connection, are they? Now, that doesn't mean we don't tell the story of Melchizedek. It doesn't mean we don't preach from that. But what I thought tonight is, rather than that, I would preach on the methodology of the book of Hebrews rather than the specific teachings of the book of Hebrews, if you're tracking with what I'm saying. So rather than having you open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 7, I want you to think about the whole book. I think most of us know the whole book well enough that we can kind of see what the author was doing to the Hebrew people. And I want to say, how would we follow that model as we speak about Jesus today? It's kind of an intriguing thought, isn't it? How would we do that? So let me just give us three quick ways, because I've had more time than you to work this out. So let me give you three quick ways that I think may help us get what the author of the Hebrews was doing. How do you build on what your neighbors are trusting in to have this conversation about Jesus? I'm going to suggest three things that your neighbors trust in, or that they build their lives around. One is skepticism, the other is sports, and the other is love. Skepticism, sports, and love. If the author of the Hebrews were writing to our neighbors in 2018, I think he or she might have talked about those three. The author might have said something like, your team is good, but really loses way too much. The author might have said something, that's about sports. The author might have said something like, your skepticism is a good tool, but you know, skepticism isn't really a thing, is it? It's just a tool. And the author might have said something like, you have a very pitiful love life. So just hold on to that for a minute, and we'll see if I convince you at all of the methodology. Why those three? There are others we could pull out of our neighbor's the things they're trusting in. But those three, because I think if the Hebrews were trusting in Abraham and Moses and the law, our neighbors are really trusting in their skepticism. They have placed a lot of hope in skepticism. And our neighbors are living and dying with their sports side. And our neighbors are hoping for love. I think that's why those three. So let's look at skepticism for a moment. Skepticism is how we respond to every bit of supposed news we hear. We are used to fact checking, aren't we? right? So you hear something and you say, well, I don't know. Is it real? Is it the Russians? You know, in my country, we worry about that quite a bit now. And it's not just about politics. We have learned to be skeptical about everything, and our neighbors have learned to be skeptical about making any faith decisions. Our neighbors pride themselves on not being gullible, on not being naive, on not being a sucker, on not being taken in. They pride themselves on not trusting. And here we come with a message of faith. Our neighbors mistrust trust itself. We are a people of balloon poppers. You know, just, oh, so you, oh, isn't that sweet? You are a believer, you know, and love to just kind of pop that balloon. The wisest person in the room is the one who believes the very least. I mean, this is the culture we live in. So how do Christians talk to skeptics about Jesus? What would the author of Hebrews have done? Well, let's begin, like the author of the Hebrews, by affirming their old ways. This isn't how we normally deal with it, right? We normally attack. But the author of the Hebrews affirms their old ways. The author of the Hebrews doesn't start by belittling angels. Remember, it could have, but doesn't start by belittling angels. He or she says, the message brought by Jesus is so much better than the message angels brought you. So I think we should start by affirming skepticism. Skepticism in itself is not wrong. Skepticism is actually a good thing. We believers are also, we are somewhat skeptical because we are lied to by professionals all day long. They're called adverts. And that's what they do. They tell us part of the truth to encourage us to buy their product. We see a commercial for a new drug. Now, I don't know if they do this here. Do they advertise new drugs on the telly? I don't think they do they? Yeah, well, in our country, they do it. And they advertise a new drug. You can't actually go out and buy it. You have to go to your doctor to have it prescribed. But they advertise them on the telly, and they say, here is this drug. And they show a family running, frolicking through a meadow. But because of a legal reason, they have to say all the problems that this drug can provoke. And so in the background, while the family is frolicking through the meadow, it says, this drug may make your limbs fall off. This drug, yeah, and it just goes on. And they don't do that here, right? Yeah, this is a civilized country. You are to be congratulated. Although I am somewhat skeptical of that. If you're getting on an airplane, and the captain comes on and says, we have a minor mechanical issue and are expecting a 10-minute delay. You'd be wise to be skeptical that it's going to be only 10 minutes. So, see, we have learned, all of us, to be skeptical. What an opportunity to talk about Jesus. Let's move people to build on that skepticism. So here's what we might say. Here's what the author of Hebrews might have said. Something like, skepticism is not really the opposite of belief. Skepticism is a barrier against mistaken belief. It was never intended to keep you from belief. It was only to protect you from making a tragic mistake in what you believed in. And good news, you have found him. His name's Jesus. I don't think I've convinced you, but you get the idea. You get the idea, right? This is the methodology of the author of Hebrews. Build on what they have believed in rather than battering that down. Skepticism, you know, never built anything. Skepticism never took a trip anywhere. Skepticism never built a home. Skepticism never built a building. Skepticism never started a family. In fact, a healthy skeptic, you can point this out, should be skeptical of his skepticism. Skepticism paralyzes. So I think we say something like, I get it about what you don't believe, but let me tell you about what I do believe. Right? Use skepticism to take people to believe, to see that skepticism is a tool, it's not a destination. Well, the second thing I would have us look at for just a moment is this liaison we have, this bondage, you might say, we have to sports and to our team. Now, I know I'm on thin ground here with you, and we may have to open up an altar call. But sports are as near to a religion as we have in this country. It's as near most people have to believing in something bigger than themselves. So you can go to the pitch and you can all sing together and you're a part of something big. Every day, whether it's Saturday or Sunday, every day there is a match on. We're glued to the TVs to see if our side wins. Our allegiance to our side and to their victories is huge in the life of many of our neighbors. I live in a town called Baltimore, where we have an American football team named the Ravens, and they lose a lot. And when they lose, a gloom settles over the whole city. It lasts 2 or 3 days. I'm not exaggerating, and maybe some of you live in cities like this. When that side loses, it just takes the air out of everyone. I recently saw Scotland playing England in rugby. It was in February, so it was some kind of big thing. You would understand. I just saw it. Scotland scored, and one of the Scottish fans. We were watching it on TV. One of the Scottish fans jumped up, pumped his fist. Yes, he was so excited that his side had scored. Well, he had done nothing. He was a total loser. He was sitting there watching the TV, and suddenly, yes, we scored. He had not scored. It's this vicarious living through our heroes that we have. All he had done was move his eyeballs and dilated his pupils. So what would the author of the Hebrews have said to a sports... It's not just our fascination. We're living out our lives through our sports heroes and our teams. I wonder if the author of the Hebrews might have said something like, why not pick a real hero? I don't care who your greatest sporting hero of all time is. They all eventually retired and failed us. Hopefully in that order, but sometimes they fail us and then retire. So we remember their greatest moments, but now they're gone. And in my country, they retire and spend their time golfing. But those who have chosen Jesus as their vicarious hero, the one who wins it for us, those who have chosen Jesus have an ongoing champion, a victorious living champion. Our guy does not lose. Our guy does not retire. Our guy does not play golf. So might not the author of the Hebrews have taken our fascination and really our codependent relationship upon our heroes and taken us to Jesus? Now, there were moments when our guy appeared defeated, right? There were moments when he appeared to be overwhelmed by the forces of evil, but then he burst out of the tomb, victor, the one who broke death forever. And he's not the kind of victor who just simply prances around raising a gold cup in the air. I mean, that's not the victory. The victory is the scourge of death, which has lain over all humanity for all time, has now been lifted. I mean, now that's a victory. That's something worth it. He didn't defeat Liverpool on Saturday afternoon. He defeated death on Sunday morning. I mean, we have a true champion. Our side does not lose. He is the warrior who has defeated the ultimate enemy, death itself. That's not false drama. That's not the kind of drama that the commentators have to work up. That's a drama that matters to every one of our neighbors, death itself. So again, ordinance, I'm just suggesting that you're not being ordained to explain obscure historical lessons to your neighbors. You're not being ordained to only, it's a good thing to do, but to only parse the Bible for people who already get it. You are also being ordained to effectively communicate the gospel to the people he loves but do not yet get it. And this will require some creativity. Now, we're not writing new books of the Bible. You know that, right? But the Bible doesn't just communicate a message, it communicates a how to communicate a message. Third thing, which we will briefly mention, is what our neighbors are most hoping for and most disappointed by, and that is love. The number one song on the charts in England right now is One Kiss. It's on the radio. A lot of blank looks. It's a song. One Kiss is the title. We need to get out more, friends. Maybe it's on the internet. I don't know. Find it somewhere out there. So most of our neighbors, I mean, I'm just illustrating, right? One Kiss. It's a romance thing. This is what fuels our society. It's this fantasy about love. So most of our neighbors are enthralled by the idea of love and yet bitterly disappointed by their own experiences of love. I mean, lives are a mess, aren't they? Love lives are a mess, aren't they? Yvonne and I, so we've been married 42 years. We're in love. We will walk through an airport, and we often just walk, and we'll pull our little suitcase in one hand, and we'll hold hands with the other hand. And people stop and stare. And I'm like, yeah. No, you know what they're staring about. Two old people in love. Now, I've practiced this sound. This is the sound they make, but it's kind of a female sound, so excuse me. But they go, aw. Is that a Brit? Do they do that here? Aw. You know what that means? I want that. I want to get old and be in love with the one I love. I want that. I want that kind of, and yet very few people have that of our neighbors, don't they? So what would the author of the Hebrews do? Perhaps he would take them from this desire to love to the reality of love. I think he or she would say something like, every frustration about love that you've had in your life has been leading you toward Jesus. Go there. You'll find it there. I think he or she would say, your broken hearts, your melted hearts, your lonely nights would take you there to Jesus. All of your sexual misadventures will take you there. All of your frustrations, the pain, the heartache, the resignation, all of that that you've wanted so desperately in your life. You've wanted to love and be loved and know how to have relationships. And all of those are on a pathway which take you to the author of love, the one who created you in love. And there he stands and his arms are open. He's ready to embrace you. Go there. I think the author of the Hebrews would have recognized the dearth of love, the dryness, the barrenness of love, the desert which our neighbors live in, where they see it on the telly and they think, oh yeah, I wish I had that, and the romantic comedies at the movies, and oh, I want that. And I think he or she would have let all that point to Jesus. Because that's why we're married 42 years. And people say, aw, it's because we are living the way Jesus taught to live. We are united in purpose with Jesus. We follow the Creator's plan for our lives. I mean, this is how it works, right? We have good news for people, and it connects with love. Ordinance. I recommend to you the methodology of the book of Hebrews. The methodology. Yes, we will preach about Melchizedek, right? But for those who don't know who Melchizedek is, let's use the methodology. Let's understand our neighbors. What do they trust in? What do they long for? What's the connection between those things and Jesus? So as I say, I don't want you to write a new book of the Bible. The canon is closed. But I want you to get the idea, to follow that methodology and ensure that your message is a message that connects your neighbors to God. Amen.